glasses for many years, but recently I did a reading that I didn't need my glasses at because I had a 16 font, and eventually it'll be a 24 where I'll be flipping because there'll be one word on a page. Anyway, we have some books for sale, two of Carol Frost, Pure, and Venus and Don Juan. So there's only a few copies of them. Get them fast. I like to tie things in a neat package. In order to relax, sorry, to relax from poetry, I like to watch murder. Not happening, but shows like Homicide, thus the Baltimore connection. And the last one that was on involved twins. So that was doubly interesting for me because I have a fascination with twins. Doubly interesting. I haven't watched it yet, but ending Greg's poem with double vision and then introducing a poet who is a twin, I think is very zen. And so I'd like to introduce Carol Frost.
I want to move this so that you can both hear me and I don't have a Hitler's mustache, which I noticed I was going to say something, but I didn't. So what's happening to my face? Am I having plums and mustaches go across my face? No, I don't think so. There, maybe that'll help. I gave a reading at Pomona, and my husband said afterwards, he said, great reading, but God, the lighting was terrible. It looked like Halloween. I'm going to be reading today from my new and selected, which I think finished. It's not coming out until the spring of 2000, so there might be some new poems in it. I mean, I have probably about 4 or 5 more months of new work if I want to put those in there. Well, right now it's 110 pages of poems, which I think is a lot, and I'm reading again next week at Wash U, and I didn't want to duplicate myself. I have set my book up, not knowing any better way, alphabetically, and in order to keep myself from reading any poems twice, I've decided to read from the first half of the alphabet tonight, and then next week from the second half of the alphabet. This will still be a complete reading, don't worry. I'll be reading a lot of poems that are from the new book, the latest books, Venus and Don Juan and Pure, which I guess you're selling. I brought them up just so it looks like this is a real reading and not just new stuff. Although some of it is, of course, new. This poem is called Apology. Already the land is starting to forget gardens. Reminiscences no longer hold the heart completely, as someone held her a little roughly once in somber, sweet groves, and the touch she was utterly dissolute to that caused collapse behind her knees, sun slides in the lake. She feels a resistance toward, then apology. As if a thorn catching her sweater has torn a small hole, as if she shouldn't have worn the sweater. What induces, then weakens the greater and lesser passions is what she'd like to know. Something like the green underneath red and yellow, which is now wilting, has left her body, and she is someone who had loved and is no longer availing and can neither take nor give away. The speaker in this next poem is drugged. The poem is called Apple Rind. Is my voice going in and out? It feels that way a little bit to me. Is it? You don't give a damn. I do. There. We'll try this. Someone else was afraid and spoke to me, and I couldn't answer, swallowing oxygen from a tube. And then the cool blade freeing rind from an apple, like the first touch of day. How long I'd been in someone's still life, the blade hidden, dividing, and was helpless. Perfectly drugged, I lay just shy of winter in my own mind. My cut chest felt nothing, no terror, no pain. And there were morphine sweet and fruit boxes piled on the white terrain, like reasons for lives and death. The orchard was weathered to admonitory bareness, except for a few frozen apples above a disturbance of snow, the hoof prints of deer coming by several routes to this late harvest, the dim haunches and various limbs afloat on movement that can break or double back into the gray calm of the woods. How to explain directions a mind takes, or why I told no one how much I wanted to come back to this beautiful, stupid world. I've been working on a series of poems in the last 5 years, 11-line poems that work a little bit like sonnets, but I don't think of them really as sonnets so much as of my own invention. They're 11 lines long. They have very long lines. I try to have very long sentences as well. The title of the poem is an abstraction, and the abstract word has to appear somewhere in the poem itself. I'm writing a kind of, I think, a kind of lexicon for abstractions, which I think are difficult to define or explain, nearly ineffable. You'll hear some of the other rules and principles, I think, as you hear some of these. This one is called At, which has an R in it. In the middle, wise guy. Yeah. Why, when she gave her memory a mother whose cruelty was godly and who was beautiful, and the North African boy of 20 in the Paris of her youth who tore down his fresco at the end of every day because the cement hardened before he could paint his red angels, je ne sais quand, he'd say. And memory knew she loved them, did it refuse to say so. She imagined she saw its gorge fall as after swallowing, and her own mouth felt like cotton. She wanted to write it all down. What could tell her she would have to forget herself, her art, everything, and make herself stare at a lake where a dragonfly stared at a tree, at nothing, then deposited its eggs in the still water and left, as if it trusted or could go on without. Whenever I get around Greg, I think I should read a formal poem. A poem that rhymes, at least. They're all fairly formal. This poem started as a joke, started because I was pissed off, and that's a good reason for humor. I had gone to Vienna to do a series of translations of female Austrian poets, Viennese poets, and found a poet I liked very much, Jutta Schütting, and worked hard on some of her poems. And then another time I went back to Vienna, I went to a bookstore to get a few more of her books, and was told by the bookstore owner, who laughed, chortled, actually, that I must mean not Yuta Shooting, but Julian Shooting. That she had had a sex change operation, which seriously threw a monkey wrench into my into my plans to publish female Austrian writers. You're getting it. So I was annoyed. And I thought, in a mood, well, all right, people are having sex change operations, you know, left and right. How about writing a poem about, why don't people have species change operations? That's what I was thinking. And then I thought, well, I'll write a poem about a species change operation. And I thought, first of all, snake. But then that seemed too easy. You know, you just lop off the arms and tie the feet together. But, I mean, it's not really very exciting. So I did a little research and decided that geese of a certain kind, gray-legged geese, would be good. But then the poem gets serious, and this entire introduction is leading you off the track, away. One, their breasts and abdomens filled with air, gray-legged geese saw on thermals between God's feet and hair. The autumn light is silver and rose, foreign, and their flight is like some distant, almost invisible allegory of what has gone out of a person's life, less like the dying away of a cord than a hand of pomegranate seeds and Persephone. The bodies of geese are light, the bones porous, hollowed to extreme thinness, built exactly right for leaving the gravel bed, and I imagine their tender, lazy lack of heart as the trees rage into another season. Two, just as the spring, which somehow begins and is nowhere, changes, or a hand which reaches for an unexpected reason and doesn't take my hand, not yet, so the somewhere that lies beyond me becomes a disfigured garden, cold and wet, yet not all there. It's as if it longed for me or not for me. I heard voices, tender, primal, speak to me, sing to me, and remain a sorrow. And the hot air one September slathered my back and shoulders with wax so that the colored leaves caught there like feathers. Lightly as after death, I imagine myself in skies past this one, for there's no one any place who isn't secretly going away. Balance. It's another 11-liner. I think I cheat in this one. It's fun to make a form because then you can start breaking the rules. You can start cheating, and that's a great pleasure in poetry and of poets. Balance is how you carry it, how it is. For example, turkeys, which seemed ordinary, grazing through the piled brush for butternuts, all head and feathers, then taking the shot because they didn't see you standing on a stump, one dying outright, the other baffled, half rising in the brown light and batted to the ground. How ungainly large they made the afternoon, heaping up out of slopes, trees, torn pieces of clouds, and excitement. When you stopped running, you took them out from under your jacket where they had kept shifting and threatening to slip out, still with a bit of warmth in them, and grasped one in each hand by its horned feet like handles to steady yourself, leaning into the land's steepness and accord, growing used to them, their difference. I have a couple of favorite artists, Austrian artists. One is Gustav Klimt, who died in 1918 after a stroke. And he was sent to the hospital before he died. And while he was in the hospital, thieves broke into his atelier and stole some money. They were discovered, or rather, they weren't discovered, but the theft was discovered, and the police who came also discovered what they figured was Klimt's secret. Now, Klimt paints a kind of ornamental and very sensual painting, very often of women dressed in elaborate gowns, but elaborate, but not, but geometric in their design, and yet they're very sensual. The women are, and what they discovered is that in the painting called The Bride, which he had not finished, he first of all drew the woman, or painted the woman, naked, and then after he had painted that, then he began to dress her. And the naked version of the woman was very, very exact, sexually or erotically exact. The poem is called The Bride. On a day snow flicks and swirls, and the Danube lies like a great silver fish, the wind and waves can no longer jostle. Klimt lies paralyzed as if the bare space in the hospital room has let its weight down on his chest. Soon he begins to see in the white slaked walls a subtle, almost graffito flower fill, and a woman unlike anyone he has ever met. The thigh, the naked foot, and the stirred up mists of her shoulders and face. He thinks of his painting, The Bride, and how beneath the scrolls and orange flowers with their sconces full of sap, the hairs of his brush caressed the girl. He'd begun to fill in the anatomy of her skirt, stippling the fallen petals and the pollen upon the Baroque cloth to wrap her nude legs and pubis. Smiling, he thinks of his lover, Emily, in summer, her surprise when she raised the well bucket and found a salamander bobbing there, and how a garden is rhythmically absorbed into the figure of a woman in the sun. He closes his eyes to imagine the rouged faces and pale translucency of breast and limb entangled in ornate silks near the girl, whose unfinished face makes the beholder more aware they are parts of her dream, which swirl in space, in color, just below the surface of her thought. Klimt tries to sit up. He looks at the winter bouquet of flowers on his bedstand. Tomorrow he'll color the apparatus and light of these blossoms on the girl's skin with the brush's very tip, he thinks, taking his time so not to wake her in her dreamt garden until all the ovals, spirals, swirls, and triangles tipped on their heads are worthy of a bride's reverie. Only then will he know which qualities of her eyes, smoky green with morning and rain, or heavily lidded as though from pollen, to bring to life. The woman in the purity of the white wall waits, or seems to, like a bride. Klimt wants her to dress and to remain as if in a ceremony of sunlight, but reminded of her nakedness, the marriage beds, as he, by gaslight on stone and by the snow, is aware of the bitter ease of the grave beneath a bed of flowers. The next time he closes his eyes, he feels the earth open for them. He feels the earth open for him, the dark ajar, the soil spangled with gold, an inert, unmoving flame, and then a huge body, a blackness, has hold of him. with a group of students to, not from here, from New York. The students were from New York, to the Keys, and we were walking along the beach, and we found the ugliest creature in the world. It was washed up on the shore. It looked like a galosh. It was still alive, and it looked like it was in need of some kind of help. We wanted to throw it back in the water, but it was far too ugly to touch. So I persuaded one of my students to make a bed of sand, a cushion of sand underneath the creature to lift it up so no one would have to touch it. And I could stay further away than he would have to. And then he threw it into the water. And by the time we had done all of this, we had a huge crowd, you know, 30 or 40 people. And people ran out to see what would happen. And the creature let go of a beautiful purplish dye. And I remember thinking, you son of a gun, you've heard it. And, oh, it's saying thank you. The poem is called Chimera. It's which is simply a fanciful creature, an imaginary creature, which was once part lion, part eagle, but now can be a lot of different combinations, and refers to a painting by Hieronymus Bosch, where the rebellious angels thrown out of heaven, falling to earth, are turning into impossible chimera, impossible creatures. It seemed to me, looking at that painting, though, that it was a rather friendly painting, that somehow Bosch might have been saying that Earth was the place where creatures, ugly creatures, would be allowed, unlike in heaven, where they are, as you know, where they, as you know, have to be perfect. Chimera. By the verge of the sea, a man finds a gelatinous creature, parching, thick as a shoe, its head a doubtful dark green, that leans toward him as he bends near in some dark wonderment of his own. The sky is haunted by pure light, the sea a rough mixture of blue and green and black. Suddenly, he hears the air rent with loud cries and looks to see pelicans on the piers raising their wings, then falling, changing shape to dive into the sea. He thinks of Bosch's rebellious angels changing shape as they are pursued out of the immaculate sky. Who are they? Angels who accept the hideous and monstrous. Fallen, they make up a nightmare fauna. Say the sea is to be questioned. Below the bonds of this estate, through rainbowed cold, the rock-headed and cord of bone, the chimera our madness does not cease to reinvent, and which we dare not think alive, crawls in a thick ooze. Yet even this one, torn to the plain insides and leaking dyes, exudes a gentle unrest of the soul. Is it not good? The man pauses, looks around. The sea undulates, sharpening and smoothing all the grooves that history has graven on the sand. Then he puts his hands under the terrible flesh and heaves it as far as he can back into the Atlantic, as if it were the mirror of a lost estate, the dawn time of the world's first season. Comfort. Because a sorrow was conquered, or a sin, can they relax? No. Having felt hands crush and throw them down, they see the ones in pieces everywhere and hear the eerie beat of their madness. It trembles in the wings of hummingbirds, aloft as they eat, flying backwards. So they persist without knowing, and having been forbidden presence to push and cajole the ones on their knees, in balls, in theirs and others' beds, in hell, to their feet, so that they can find a way for themselves out into an airy place. There they take down the hands flung before the face and help to wash the inflamed portions of the others' hats, so much like their own, invisibly anointing whomever they can with oils, until and when the soft pounding of their blood becomes comforting, like being held again in someone's arms. Compatibility. Never after was life so filled with meeting, with reuniting and drawing apart as then, when bed hot, filled with surges, the man and woman began to know each other. It was like the makeshift walking of geese toward water, a settling into themselves and, with a fiercer and fiercer grip, a testing of the untried other. How safe they'd been before they touched, and he asked her one thing which she meant to resist but was unable to. How beautiful to keep one's fabled eyes closed. Was another's body not like some bright obstruction? But they, as if they knew nothing, opened entirely, bending to two wills, striking down vanities, feeling what lay deep inside the darker compatibilities, until love seemed causal, not just related. Their sinuous tongues used the word over and over without speaking. Conscience. The crow settles on a fir bough, the crow settles on a fir bough and disappears, the way an usher waits by the threshold to the old Dutch master's room and watches. What does he think? Not even the hunters and the dogs are reminders that the crow exists, and it would seem that he would never come back, reuniting with others in the winter sky and moving off, until he does. A caw falls like a reprimand from his beak, and he emerges in his uniform black, his wings trembling stiffly with their stiff ends. It is hard not to feel anger at his assertion, how one feels life's unfairness and little to help us in our hard choices. What use the silence, semblance, and austere flying? As the deep woods tower above, full of shapes, and the heavens threaten snow, something is moving near as if it wanted to tear us from our molds as a conscience is torn. Country, tables, chairs, a used refrigerator in a thicket of zinnias, a woman lifting a window blind, a man crippled with fat who waves hello, his dog on a short chain prowling in front of his angry shed, the fur unkempt and bearding, fervent as Rasputin to wrench free and get to a new voice and a stranger's scent, the garden primeval with snails wrung with yesterday's rain, and the tire gardens, the pink and yellow rubber ringing the geraniums, the established names on the mailboxes and gravestones weathering the rich light and the smell of old lilacs, the tin advertisements for farm machinery rusting on the milk houses, the lines of light between planks, crookedly spaced wasps' nests, starlings, the surveyor's orange flags, the wrecked autos like specialty stores in a fenced lot, and the auction block, the brisk rhythm of selling, going, gone. It is a journey they no longer can keep ahead of, as under a tent a revivalist and congregation melt into one large droning, or it is a big top, the women tidying the trailers, tidying the junk, with Lonesome Road on the radio, the men drinking beer around the clock, revving their engines, and the mutt at leash end crashing left and right. another poem by another painter I like. I promised you two, or didn't promise you a darn thing, but did tell you that there were two Austrian painters I like. And another one who was a student of Klimt's was Egon Schiele. Now, Egon Schiele died very soon after Klimt did. He died in the influenza epidemic I'm not sure if it was the same year that Klimt died or not. But he was the heir apparent to Klimt, and had painted his Klimt's death mask. His wife came down with the flu and died. And the day before she died, he drew her portrait. And she asked him, he asked her after he finished if she would please write down that she loved him. And she said, "Well, of course I love you. You know that." And he said, "No, I want you to write it down," which she did. And then she died, and 2 days later, Egon Schiele died as well. Now, the other thing you need to know about this poem is that she was one of his models, and that he's known for his erotic paintings. More since her illness, he tried to think of her not purely as wife, as someone who finds herself trying to please, to be of his mind. The spread legs and bunched up slip, the reddened labia, and an almost compulsive abandonment. They were his wishes. As for her, sprawled like a goose sideways down the wind whenever he drew her, sex, what was in fevered began slowly to fade, and she was lost to him. You know how that feels. He drew her face, then gave her pen and paper so that she might leave behind for him love's avowals. In the weirdly devastated eyes of the earlier self-portraits, where aloneness exaggerates everything, he hadn't yet mourned, yet almost seemed to know. She'd have gladly lingered in that yellow and ochre room that willed and willed and willed her for just a bit longer, but found death determined and went with him, whose whispered secrets and stale fragrance mingled with decay excited her. The artist stepped to the morning window and looked at the quieted down square. A clearer feeling now, the nude heart in ecclesiastical colors above the city's grayness, their erotic life. And something more, exhaustion, like halos in an unexpected gust of wind surrounding a tree's last leaves. I'm to the F's. I only go to I. I might do a J. This poem is written really for Bill Matthews, good friend of mine, and for Larry Levis, another good friend. I don't think there's anything that needs to be clarified. As I said, it's called Flicker, after the bird. The flicker, it has a little head note from Bill Matthews. Beauty is for amateurs. Chisel-billed eye cerulean with a crimson nuchal patch, Flicker lay on the ground, still warm, and went on aging. Intricate, stricken watch, pear in a desiccating wind. I brought it home and began with the box of watercolors to wash the eye with milk for the clouds and sky it fell from, then dragged my partly dried brush over the rough paper surface for true textures on the wings, imagining old orchards, umber and sienna, where I'd seen the undulating flight of loose flocks. I studied the yellow undertail, then daubed with the colored water along the gray and dun stripes. As for my pulse, I felt for temperament, for gravestone, for shadow, to affect the utter silence after a long, long day of call, portal, pia, drum, and wicca. Then I blotted and scraped the throat. I saw dusk falling like a comment on each detail that led to it and gradually was lost and leaving. A hint of song must be caught, a clarity of neither light nor memory, and it must be in the physical form of the flicker and the orchard where the wind makes a soft racket, song that breaks the learned hat. I stared and stared by lamplight, stroking the white, thinking sour gum, dogwood, poison ivy berry, river mist, imagining the free side of the hills, when a bead of liquid formed in the flicker's beak and pooled on my desk. My evasions went up in smoke. With colors, tones, casements, and stars with exact names, who could but feign the moments once lived that will never be lived again? Who has a home in this good world and doesn't yearn? I do. It's mine. I do. Fury. And the whole night she had told herself to be pleasant as she lay by the sleeping man. And she'd gladly have listened to herself. But as the enormous dawn sneaked into their darkness and seized them in its paws, she found herself with the old fury, past her carefulest politeness. She saw she'd need millennia to find a way to comprehend the reason for the difference behind their early ideals, a garden where plums and peaches grew well and tasted wild, and they were unembarrassed by genitals. And what had become of them? This apple pose, it was no good blaming God or Adam, she knew, but she couldn't help herself. Why hadn't the one spoken forthrightly, and had the other caved in? Then, hardly allowing him to waken, she said her first sarcasm. Then another. Now, you see, I think that's terribly funny. She had only begun to get used to her body's exposures to pain, like the insinuations behind questions. Winter asking the tree, "Where's your strength?" A priest asking a soul, "Where's your marrow?" Aversions, truth, invective. It wasn't her answers which mattered, only her lying on a bed being administered shocks until the world grew tired of experimenting with another bit of clay and the inward liberties. So it seemed. And when the intern came into the room, asking how she was and snouting through her chest with drainage tubes, as strong a desire as she'd ever had rose up in her. She must have gestured, or he already knew, because, as if in expectation, he smiled at her and stepped out of Ham's way backward for just a moment. Horror. When horror, that with pretty masks no longer stood to one side as he walked from his house to the garden, extolling neither the magic of the atmosphere nor his medals that he earned for painting, but undefinable, still deferred, as if somewhere a prophet had put down his hood and bellowed, grew colossal, Goya put 14 black versions of it on his interior walls, the most audacious a dog whose trespasses have sunk him in an abstract grave. That he cannot go to the master toward whom he is looking is in the slight blue stain in the dog's eyes, that Goya wanted the whole room to see how terribly the dog wanted to go is in the tipped yellow absence above his head. This is how it was and how it is, caught, wholly tempted, without a clue. How little has Ott driven off. I'll read two more. This is the two-poem warning. Two 11-liners. This is imagination. Imagine that there are several paths, but none takes her away. Whether she goes past the laid-up stones of the dam in a pent-up pond, or into some foreign silent meadow with raspberry canes, she returns to the same shaded entrance, as if she could never err. Her mind won't let her. Numbed and insane, she feels like someone's trapped stone creature, a weather-beaten sylph holding onto a gate. Why doesn't she just go, avoiding turns to the left and right, until everything behind her is unfamiliar, unrelated, and she can be utterly new? You may ask, but what do you know with your maps, books, and clocks? Stuck as you are, will you yank off the silent dial face and, taking no counsel, walk unfettered into the wild north fields? Joy. That Noah's joy lasted only for a time, presses itself on the heart and mind. When they called him foolish, he went on building. But then among the drowned, like soaking marionettes, the ark bobbed so that even his closest friend meant nothing to the father. How could he hold on to his beliefs? Like the caged beast roaring, and as the wind beat itself on the water and the hull, wouldn't he have liked to ease himself with yelling? Suddenly it comes to you. He did yell. The trust he'd flung out with such abandon was absorbed by the gray pall. And you harden yourself against the appearance of the land bird, as if sunning his anguish and walking in washed and earth-spiced air could rid the nostrils of the stench of the past 40 days, a consummation that makes the sweat grow cold. Thank you.